did, yes you did. And I thank you. You didn't have to squeeze me like you did, but you did, yes you did. And I thank you. Thank you, girl. I thank you, woman. Thank you, baby. Thank you, honey. Thank you. I thank you. Oh, baby. Thank you, girl. Thank you, woman. Thank you, honey. Woo-hoo. Oh, yeah. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
And thank you from the bottom of my heart. You're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM right here in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up next is Fiction Jones after a couple of brief announcements.
Hi, WORT listeners. Nominations for Madison Magazine's Best of Madison competition are now open through the end of February, and WORT qualifies this year in four categories: Best Local Podcast, Best Radio Team, Best Local News Site, and the brand new category of Best Volunteer Opportunity. WORT has fantastic local news, so that one's pretty easy, as well as many podcasts and radio teams. Think about your favorite shows, and chances are that at least one of them fits into these categories. WORT also boasts a crew of over 300 volunteers, so we're a shoo-in for Best Volunteer Opportunity. But we need your vote. How do you vote? We've made it simple. Just go to tinyurl.com/best WORT to cast your vote. And you can nominate your favorites every day through the end of the month, so vote early and vote often. The final voting will take place in June. Thank you in advance.
Thank you. Now listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper layer, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. 2. Your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. 3. The warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. 4. Your feet and your legs get heavier. 5. The warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. On 6, I want you to go deeper. I say 6. And the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. 7. You go deeper and deeper and deeper. 8. On every breath you take, you go deeper. 9. You are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You are walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
You're in the United States, or what's left of it. The year is 2025. And this is it. This is our winter pledge drive. 25 years with WORT's Fiction Jones. 50 years with WRT as an independent, listener-sponsored community radio station. One of the beacons, one of the bastions, part of the ramparts. We're so lucky to be here. We've got a place to fight from. Celebrate with me. And give us a call tonight, especially tonight. 256-2001, or you can pledge online at WORTFM.org. If you're a lapsed donor, which means you haven't given to the station in the past 18 months, we'll have your donations doubled through the same matching grant. This is a great time to support independent media, to support one of the things that they really don't like. Would really like to see wiped out. So, give us a call tonight. That would be great. My name is Greg Willard, and this show is called Fiction Jones. Like I mentioned before, it's a book reading hour. Nothing terribly new or original, but I think books and radio have a really intimate and vital kind of relationship. I grew up listening to radio shows where various hosts were reading books of different kinds. And of course, radio drama, which was largely gone by the time I was growing up, but I would hear compilations of old-time radio shows and wish that I'd been born 20 or 30 years earlier. But hey, we can do the same thing here, even better. And I have. Almost 20 years of reading books on the air, live, unabridged, Stephen Milhauser, Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, Emily Bronte, Mary Shelley, Rachel Kushner, Dostoevsky, Joyce, A.E. Van Vogt, Carol Emschweiler, Melville, Anne Carson, Dickens, Kafka, Bruno Schultz, and on and on. Nobody's ever told me what to read. I just read the stuff that I want to hear aloud, and I hope you do too. And it's always like really weird stuff. And this is something that an independent media can do. And I maintain it's an intensely political, committed act to read literature on the radio late at night. It's gloriously uncommercial. And you can celebrate that with me tonight just by listening in, but also giving us a call, showing a little support. Any amount is good. I'm not particular. 256-2001. We'll take your calls. We'll take your pledges. We'll thank the stars. And we'll keep going. And mark my words, things are going to turn. I know they are. Tonight, we're going to start a new book, too. This book is called A Voyage to Arcturus by David Lindsay. Not a real well-known book, but it's got a certain kind of underground reputation. It was published in 1920. It was, and is, a really influential, visionary science fiction fantasy. It's got an introduction by Lauren Isley. I'm sorry. The author is David Lindsay. Lauren Isley was a really prominent natural history writer and an early appreciator of this book, so he's got some interesting things to say about it. Let me read you from the introduction a little bit. And as I'm reading, just, you know, you can go to the phone and give us a call and pledge a little bit. So the introduction to A Voyage to Arcturus by David Lindsay. It is, this book, in reality, a long Earth journey. So interpreted, it is a tale of travels that few among us possess the imagination or the courage or the ever-present symbolism to sustain. The book is an amalgam of strange philosophies clothed in weird exterior forms that have taken shape in a fantastically gifted, if somewhat elusive, mind. As one of his Arcturian characters remarks, of a haunting and formidable music, which it is the aim of the hero to investigate, the man that can play the instrument would be able to conjure up the most astonishing forms, which are not phantasms, but realities. David Lindsay, the author of A Voyage to Arcturus, comes very close to being such a musician. In spite of a prose that, which is occasionally rude and awkward, in spite of characters which appear and vanish quickly, in some instances before we can quite grasp their significance, in spite of a plethora of overdramatic names like Maskall and Nightspore, Lindsay produced a book which it is difficult, if not impossible, to lay down once one has entered the observatory tower where the journey starts and glimpsed the dread blue star, which revolves by far-off torments. David Lindsay died young. One must be tolerant, therefore, if his message, even his unearthly music, is rasped from a not-quite-perfected instrument, or if his compositions seem too complex for our ears. The importance of this young, forgotten writer lies in the fact that his book has refused to die, that it has occupied the libraries of bibliophiles and received the devoted attention of such gifted men as Frank Lloyd Wright. The book, to hold such attention, must contain some message from the world of Nightspore, from the soul beyond death. The message is cryptic, admittedly. If, however, one reads, not lightly, but again and again, one is conscious of an always shifting point of view, which is a true part of the fragmented world we occupy. The messages derived from the fragments cannot be the message from the whole. Even Maskall, the seeker, collapses before the labyrinthine thought which permeates Lindsay's conclusion. To it I will return, but first I wish to establish the reality of this Arcturian landscape and equate it with the things on Earth. I do so for one purpose only, that we do not mistake Arcturus in this day of easy science fiction for a superficial tale of odd beings with odd organs on a planet remote from our own. This is not a common story of adventure. Rather, it's a story of the most dangerous journey in the world, the journey into the self and beyond the self. Let me illustrate. A few days ago, on a West Indian island, I walked at low tide through the wet sand and coral which afforded the background of half a dozen living worlds. I thought, as I waded through this weird and glimmering domain of life, of a remark that the philosopher George Santayana had made long ago. Prodigious complexity, he had observed, is something to which nature is not averse, like a human artist, but on the contrary is a positively prone. A jellyfish, 95% water, yet somehow alive, pumped past me, stoutly working its little translucent umbrella, as though it could neither hear nor was on its way about to be dashed into oblivion upon the shore. Down in the weeds, his appropriated shell festooned with all manner of concealed bric-a-brac, lurked a hermit crab. Something unidentifiable with mottled green tentacles grasped at my sandals. In another spot, a slippery proboscis, just protruding from the sand, descended faster than I could uncover it. Farther along, a great tiger-colored slug, whose pseudo-eyes gave it the expression of a formidable fish, grazed amidst the bottom plants. Once a bright blue butterfly object hovered in the water, and as I tried to grasp it, vanished with a total magical directness that was inexpressibly startling. I disturbed a delicate pale blue shrimp hiding in the mouth of an anemone with stinging nettles. I encountered a sidling crab concealed by claws which had been modeled to fit over his entire face like a medieval helmet. He could only momentarily be persuaded to drop this enormous guard. Just his eyes were alive, twiddling like small twin periscopes above his armor. It became obvious, as I studied him, that he was engaged in some effort at total disinvolvement with the world. Now, if I had chosen to walk through these tide pools with the mind and thirsty imagination of a David Lindsay, I believe it would have been possible, even without two twin sons of Branchspell and Alplane, to have observed the winds of the country of Matterplay. And if I had been able, like Lindsay, to humanize and make articulate this fantastic and diverse array, its voices would have been equally dissembling in expressing their interpretations of the universe. The double-sexed would have spoken their views of life, as would the blind from the deep caves of the coral. The multiple-personed Portuguese man-of-war might have had a philosophy, or the starfish some radial pure delight, unnote to creatures of mere bilateral symmetry. In a similar and equally bewildered fashion, Maskell, who is really a kind of symbolic everyman, journeys through the wilds of the Arcturian planet Tormance, seeking from its strange inhabitants the meaning of the universe, some word of its creator. He follows a mysterious drumbeat, which, toward the end of the story, we come to suspect is the exteriorized music of his own beating heart. And this is Greg Willer with Fiction Jones, and it's our winter pledge drive, so please think about giving us a call here for a moment. I'll take a pause from the reading. You can call us up at 256-2001. I'd love to hear from you tonight. And that's it. I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. A Voyage to Arcturus by David Lindsay. Chapter 1. The Seance. On a March evening at 8 o'clock, Backhouse, the medium, a fast-rising star in the psychic world, was ushered into the study of Prolands, the Hampstead residence of Montague Fall. The room was illuminated only by the light of a blazing fire. The host, eyeing him with indolent curiosity, got up, and the usual conventional greetings were exchanged. Having indicated an easy chair before the fire to his guest, the South American merchant sank back again into his own. The electric light was switched on. Fall's prominent, clear-cut features, metallic-looking skin, and general air of bored impassiveness did not seem greatly to impress the medium, who was accustomed to regard men from a special angle. Backhouse, on the contrary, was a novelty to the merchant. As he tranquilly studied him through half-closed lids and the smoke of a cigar, he wondered how this little, thick-set person with the pointed beard contrived to remain so fresh and sane in appearance, in view of the morbid nature of his occupation. "Do you smoke?" drawled Fall, by way of starting the conversation. "No? Then will you take a drink?" "Not at present, thank you." A pause. "Everything is satisfactory. The materialization will take place?"
"I see no reason to doubt it."
"That's good, for I would not like my guests to be disappointed. I have your check written out in my pocket." "Afterward will do quite well." 9 o'clock was the time specified, I believe?"
"I fancy so."
The conversation continued to flag. Fall sprawled in his chair and remained apathetic. "Would you care to hear what arrangements I have made?"
"I am unaware that any are necessary beyond chairs for your guests.
I mean the decoration of the seance room, the music, and so forth." Backhouse stared at his guest, at his host.
"This is not a theatrical performance."
"That's correct. Perhaps I ought to explain. There will be ladies present, and ladies, you know, are aesthetically inclined.
In that case, I have no objection. I only hope they will enjoy the performance to the end."
He spoke rather dryly.
"Well, that's all right then," said Fall.
Flicking his cigar into the fire, he got up and helped himself to whiskey.
"Will you come and see the room?"
"Thank you, no. I prefer to have nothing to do with it until the time arrives."
"Then let's go see my sister, Mrs. Jameson, who is in the drawing room. She sometimes does me the kindness to act as my hostess, as I'm unmarried."
"I'll be delighted," said Backhouse coldly.
They found the lady alone, sitting by the open pianoforte, in a pensive attitude. She'd been playing Scriabin and was overcome. The medium took in her small, tight, patrician features and porcelain-like hands and wondered how Fall came by such a sister. She received him bravely, with just a shade of quiet emotion. He was used to such receptions at the hands of the sex and knew well how to respond to them.
"What amazes me," she half whispered after 10 minutes of graceful, hollow conversation, "is, if you might know, not so much the manifestation itself, though that will surely be wonderful, as your assurance that it will take place. Tell me the grounds of your confidence."
"I dream with open eyes," he answered, looking around at the door. "Others see my dreams. That's all."
"But that's beautiful," responded Mrs. Jameson. She smiled rather absently, for the first guest had just entered. It was Kent Smith, the ex-magistrate, celebrated for his shrewd judicial humor, which, however, he had the good sense not to attempt to carry into private life. Although well on the wrong side of 70, his eyes were still disconcertingly bright. With selective skill of an old man, he immediately settled himself in the most comfortable of the many comfortable chairs. So we are to see wonders tonight. Fresh material for your autobiography, remarked Fall. Oh, you should not have mentioned my unfortunate book. An old public servant is merely amusing himself in his retirement, Mr. Backhouse. You have no cause for alarm. I've studied in the school of discretion. I'm not alarmed. There can be no possible objection to your publishing whatever you please. You are most kind, said the old man, with a cunning smile. Trent is not coming tonight, remarked Mrs. Jameson, throwing a curious little glance at her brother. I never thought he would. It's not in his line. Mrs. Trent, you must understand, she went on, addressing the ex-magistrate, has placed us all under a debt of gratitude. She has decorated the old lounge hall upstairs most beautifully and has secured the services of the sweetest little orchestra. But this is Roman magnificence. Backhouse thinks the spirit should be treated with more deference, laughed Fall. Surely, Mr. Backhouse, a poetic environment. Pardon me, I'm just a simple man. I always prefer to reduce things to elemental simplicity. I raise no opposition, but I express my opinion. Nature is one thing, art another. And I'm not sure that I don't agree with you, said the ex-magistrate. An occasion like this ought to be simple, to guard against the possibility of deception, if you will forgive my bluntness, Mr. Backhouse. We shall see it in full light, replied Backhouse, and every opportunity will be given to all inspect the room. I shall also ask you to submit me to a personal examination. A rather embarrassed silence followed. It was broken by the arrival of two more guests, who entered together. These were Pryor, the prosperous city coffee importer, and Lang, the stock jobber, well known in his own circle as an amateur prestidigitator. Backhouse was slightly acquainted with the latter. Pryor, perfuming the room with a faint odor of wine and tobacco smoke, tried to introduce an atmosphere of joviality into the proceedings. Finding that no one seconded his efforts, however, he shortly subsided and fell to examining the watercolors on the walls. Lang, tall, thin, growing bald, said little, but stared at Backhouse a good deal. This is Greg Willard with Fiction Jones and the beginning of David Lindsay's A Voyage to Arcturus. In this part of the book, we're introduced to the main characters and the beginning of a seance that will take the participants into a completely unexpected world. Stay tuned. Rock tonight because this is the Winter Pledge Drive. Often my show is on the third, fourth, and fifth Friday of the month, and I often miss Pledge Drives. So this is great. We're in the right place tonight. There's some really good features of this Pledge Drive too. The lapsed donors, people who have not pledged in the past 18 months, will have their donations doubled through a matching grant. So that's a great opportunity to make your contribution twice as big. Also, we've got a number of premia that I wanted to mention at the $30 level. I Miss Nixon bumper sticker, which I never thought I would ever see, and yet it is thoroughly justified right now. At the $35 level, another WRT bumper sticker, $40 level, a Progressive magazine subscription, some nice crossbody bags with the WRT logo, and a winter hat, like a, you know, a watch cap type pullover winter hat in orange and black with the logo. That's at the $70 level. Those are, you know, nice things to have, cool things to have. Umbrellas, long sleeve t-shirts, and this I've never seen before, and it looks really neat. An El Dorado tan backpack, the kind that kind of roll up on the top, and have like khaki straps and the WRT logo again. Really cool, really nice. I am sorely tempted to get this one for myself because I'm a backpack fetishist, hopelessly caught up with bags and packs. So you can think about those things or else just pledge because you appreciate this station. You know, from a political, ideological, philosophical position, of course, this is an unimpeachably precious resource and a wonderful place, and like some promotional stuff that we've had running here, that it's a big part of what makes Madison Madison. It's a treasure and needs to be protected and supported by you and all of us. Also, you know, I like to blow my own horn and just say that where else in the world could a total stranger walk in off the street and say, I'd like to do a show here, and what kind of show, and eventually, how about I read books on the air, and any books that I want, and sometimes 19th century novels that take a year and a half to finish. Sure, go on, go ahead. From a selfish personal point of view, as a book lover, it is one of the best, if not the best way to read a book, experience a book, for yourself, to read it aloud into a microphone in a dark nighttime studio to who knows who. I don't know exactly who is listening, but I know a lot of people are. People tell me that they, they're night shift nurses or Uber drivers or just doing, you know, stuff late at night. They are night owls. They spend a lot of time alone at night, and this is part of their life. And even if it's books that you hear in fragments, you never quite get the whole thing necessarily, but even in part, it's for me, a thrilling experience. I love reading books aloud to people and to all of you. And it's a real privilege to be able to do it on the radio, which is a medium that I love deeply. Radio, books, art, movies is the stuff that sustains me through everything. So if you're like that at all, give us a call here at 256-2001. Celebrate and support a human-made, independent, commercial-free medium. Totally against the grain that is emerging right now in the United States and resistant to those forces that want to crush us, but they will not. And one of the reasons they will not is because you're out there, you're listening, and you believe in what we're doing. So give me a call here and give us a call at 256-2001, or you can pledge online at WRTFM.org. We can get back to the book in a moment. Rather embarrassed silence followed. It was broken by the arrival of two more guests who entered together. These were Pryor, the prosperous city coffee importer, and Lang, the stock jobber, well known in his own circle as an amateur prestidigitator, well known in his own circle and outside of it as well. Backhouse was slightly acquainted with the latter. Pryor, perfuming the room with the faint odor of wine and tobacco smoke, tried to introduce an atmosphere of joviality into the proceedings. Finding that no one seconded his efforts, however, he shortly subsided and fell to examining the watercolors on the walls. Lang, tall, thin, and growing bald, said little, but stared at Backhouse a good deal. Coffee, liqueurs, and cigarettes were now brought in. Everyone partook, except Lang and the medium. At the same moment, Professor Halbert was announced. He was the eminent psychologist, the author and lecturer on crime, insanity, genius, and so forth, considered in their mental aspects. His presence at such a gathering somewhat mystified the other guests, but all felt as if the object of their meeting had immediately acquired additional solemnity. He was small, meager-looking, and mild in a manner, and was probably the most stubborn-brained of all that mixed company. Completely ignoring the medium, he at once sat down beside Kent Smith, with whom he began to exchange remarks. At a few minutes past the appointed hour, Mrs. Trent entered, unannounced. She was a woman of about 28. She had a white, demure, saint-like face, smooth black hair, and lips so crimson and full that they seemed to be bursting with blood. Her tall, graceful body was most expensively attired. Kisses were exchanged between her and Mrs. Jameson. She bowed to the rest of the assembly and stole a half glance and a smile at Fall. The letter gave her a queer look, and Backhouse, who lost nothing, saw the concealed barbarian in the complacent gleam of his eye. She refused the refreshment that was offered her, and Fall proposed that, as everyone had now arrived, they should adjourn to the lounge hall. Mrs. Trent held up a slender palm. "Did you or did you not give me carte blanche, Montague?" "Of course I did," said Fall, laughing. "But what's the matter? Perhaps I've been rather presumptuous, but I don't know. I've invited a couple of friends to join us. No one knows them. The two most extraordinary individuals you ever saw, and mediums, I'm sure." "It sounds very mysterious. Who are these conspirators?"
"At least tell us their names, you provoking girl," put in Mrs. Jameson.
"One rejoices in the name of Maskall, and the other in that of Nightspore. That's nearly all that I know about them, so don't overwhelm me with any more questions. But where did you pick them up? You must have picked them up somewhere." "But this is a cross-examination. Have I sinned against convention? I swear I'll tell you not another word about them. They'll be here directly, and then I will deliver them to your tender mercy."
"I don't know them," said Fall, "and nobody else seems to, but of course we will all be very pleased to have them. Shall we wait, or what?"
"I said 9, and it's past that now. It's quite possible that they may not turn up at all. Anyway, don't wait."
"I prefer to start at once," said Backhouse.
The lounge, a lofty room, 40 feet long by 20 wide, had been divided for the occasion into two equal parts by a heavy brocade curtain drawn across the middle. The far end was thus concealed. The nearer half had been converted into an auditorium by a crescent of armchairs. There was no other furniture. A large fire was burning halfway along the wall between the chair backs and the door. The room was brilliantly lighted by electric bracket lamps. A sumptuous carpet covered the floor. Having settled his guests in their seats, Fowl stepped up to the curtain and flung it aside. A replica, or nearly so, of the Drury Lane presentation of the temple scene in The Magic Flute was then exposed to view. The gloomy, massive architecture of the interior, the glowing sky above it in the background, and silhouetted against the latter, the gigantic seated statue of the pharaoh. A fantastically carved wooden couch lay before the pedestal of the statue. Near the curtain, obliquely placed to the auditorium, was a plain oak armchair for the use of the medium. Many of those present felt privately that the setting was quite inappropriate to the occasion and savored rather unpleasantly of ostentation. Backhouse, in particular, seemed put out. The usual compliments, however, were showered on Mrs. Trent as the deviser of so remarkable a theater. Fall invited his friends to step forward and examine the apartment as minutely as they might desire. Pryor and Lang were the only ones to accept. The former wandered about among the pasteboard scenery, whistling to himself and occasionally tapping a part of it with his knuckles. Lang, who was in his element, ignored the rest of his party and commenced a patient, systematic search, on his own account, for secret apparatus. Fall and Mrs. Trent stood in a corner of the temple, talking together in low tones, while Mrs. Jameson, pretending to hold Backhouse in conversation, watched them as only a deeply interested woman knows how to watch. Lang, to his own disgust, having failed to find anything of a suspicious nature, the medium now requested that his own clothing should be searched. All these precautions are quite needless, and besides the matter in hand, as you will immediately see for yourselves. My reputation demands, however, that other people who are not present would not be able to say afterward that trickery has been resorted to. To Lang again fell the ungrateful task of investigating pockets and sleeves. Within a few minutes, he expressed himself satisfied that nothing mechanical was in Backhouse's possession. The guests reseated themselves. Fall ordered two more chairs to be brought for Mrs. Trent's friends, who, however, had not arrived. He then pressed an electric bell and took his own seat. The signal was for the hidden orchestra to begin playing. A murmur of surprise passed through the audience as, without previous warning, the beautiful and solemn strains of Mozart's temple music pulsated through the air. The expectation of everyone was raised, while beneath her pallor and composure, it could be seen that Mrs. Trent was deeply moved. It was evident that aesthetically, she was by far the most important person present. Fall watched her, with his face sunk on his chest, sprawling as usual. Backhouse stood up, with one hand on the back of his chair, and began speaking. The music instantly sank to pianissimo, and remained so for as long as he was on his legs. Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness a materialization. That means you will see something appear in space that was not previously there. At first, it will appear as a vaporous form, but finally, it will be a solid body which anyone present may feel and handle, and, for example, shake hands with. For this body will be in the human shape. It will be a real man or woman, which I can't say, but a man or woman without known antecedents. If, however, you demand from me an explanation about the origin of this materialized form, where it comes from, whence the atoms and molecules composing its tissues are derived, I am unable to satisfy you. I am about to produce the phenomenon. If anyone can explain it to me afterward, I shall be very grateful. That is all I have to say. He resumed his seat, half turning his back on the assembly, and paused for a moment before beginning his task. It was precisely at this minute that the manservant opened the door and announced in a subdued but distinct voice, "Mr. Mascal, Mr. Nightspore. Everyone turned around. Fall rose to welcome the late arrivals. Backhouse also stood up and stared hard at them. The two strangers remained standing by the door, which was closed quietly behind them. They seemed to be waiting for the mild sensation caused by their appearance to subside before advancing into the room. Thanks for listening tonight. Rick's here with great music, so hang on and stay by those phones. We need your pledges. Have a wonderful night. I'll see you next week.
Pert near Sandstone, and you're listening to the XL 290 Live Music Radio Hour on 89.9 FM, WORT Madison. I don't come with the daddy, I don't
Bon dia, Madison. The Hanfibians are proud to present Madison Carnival 2025, Saturday, March 8th, live at the Majestic Theater.
Join us as we celebrate 25 years of Carnival in Madison with an evening of Brazilian drumming, dance, and culture.
The night will showcase the vibrant rhythms of the Hanfibians community bateria and the high-energy performances by Ochimo Dance and Madison Capoeira.
The event will also feature performances by bands from our samba community. Grupo Balança, Samba Novistas, Madison Choro Ensemble, Saideira Pagode, and more.
That's the Madison Carnival 25th Anniversary, March 8th at the Majestic Theater.
More information at madisoncarnival.com.
Bringing you the rich culture and music of Brazil, this is WORT Madison.
T presents Gaelic Storm with special guest Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, Roll Out the Barrel Tour, on Saturday, March 8th at 8 p.m. at the Barrymore. In the mid-1990s, Gaelic Storm kicked off its career as a pub band in Santa Monica, California. After two decades and more than 3,000 live shows,